Good morning, everyone. Thanks for joining today's webcast. And my name is Edward Kay, and I'm the Interim Chief Executive Officer and also the Chief Medical Officer for Sarepta. I want to remind everyone that I will be making a number of forward-looking statements that are subject to certain risks and uncertainties. And I would ask everyone to please refer to our SEC documents to understand these risk factors. I'm fortunate to be joined by a number of experts in the field of DMD. We're all here in Brighton in the UK at the World Muscle Society. And I've asked our researchers and collaborators to really be here so that they can give their own personal experience about the data to help understand it. And we will be presenting the data as part of a symposium later today at the World Muscle Society. So first of all, we have Ann Connolly, who is a professor of neurology and pediatrics in the neuromuscular division at Washington University School of Medicine. Jerry Mendell, who needs no introduction, is from Ohio State and also head of the gene therapy program at Nationwide Children's Hospital. Eugenio Mercuri is a professor of pediatrics in Rome at Università Cattolica di Sacro Cuore. We also have with us Perry Shea, who's an associate professor in the Department of Neurology and the director of the Neuromuscular Division at the Gelfand School of Medicine at UCLA. And finally, Steve Wilton, who is a professor and foundation chair in molecular therapy at Murdoch University in Perth. So the reason why we're having this call is we really wanted to present, you know, some of the data that will be included and has been included in our new drug application to the FDA, and also to talk about, you know, some of the accomplishments that we've been able to do in the last several months. So I'll be focusing on our intent to treat population. What we've done is look at all of the boys, the 12 patients, and compare them to an external control. In addition, we'll be talking about some of our dystrophin production using some of the methodology that we've worked in collaboration with the FDA. This is looking at RT-PCR, looking at the percent positive dystrophin fibers, dystrophin intensity, and also Western blot. We've expanded our clinical program to include boys who are younger and older, and I'll be talking about our expanded safety database that we will be submitting to the FDA. So for today's call, we'll focus on the intent to treat analysis, and this is compared to a very closely matched external control group, and this really is focusing on our primary efficacy endpoint, the intermediate clinical endpoint of six-minute walk test, that will be really the major focus of our new drug application. And I'll talk about some of our new pulmonary function that gives additional data from another organ system to talk about the effect of eteplirsen. And then, of course, our fourth biopsy, the rescore that we were asked to perform by the FDA for some of the data that's been previously published, and also our safety data. So now talking about this intent to treat analysis compared to the external control, what we were able to do is to identify two major databases that controlled really long-term six-minute walk test data that was up to 36 months and included the genetic mutation data. And importantly, it also had equivalent care standards that included the use of steroids. What was done was to prospectively define filters to identify external controls from these registries. And the three filters that we used were age, steroid use, and mutation type. So these filters were similar to what we used for our eligibility criteria for our study 201 and 202. And if we look at these two databases, they were both investigator-initiated studies, and these were the Italian Telethon Network and the Louvain Neuromuscular Research Group. And again, this contained the most data that we could use to find a similar external control group to compare. All of the patients followed the CDC Treat NMD care standards, and steroid use was recorded. Every patient who met eligibility criteria were included, and these had to attend a participating neuromuscular clinic. They had to have a genetically confirmed diagnosis of DMD, And they had to be free of any cognitive impairment that could affect the six-minute walk test. And the six-minute walk test was administered by a trained physical therapist. And these were according to the modified American Thoracic Society guidelines. These were modified by Dr. Craig McDonald and have been in use really since 2007. And each physical therapist, after following the training, followed that boy throughout the entire procedure so that we have the same physical therapist recording the six-minute walk test. And all of this data has been published previously in peer-reviewed articles. So this is how we were able to identify our external cohort. So the two databases together consisted of 186 boys. And what we did then is to start to utilize the filters. We first identified boys who were on steroids and had an identified dose, and also who had baseline and at least one post-baseline six-minute walk test that were available. Then we bifurcated according to age, those less than seven, and really identified boys that were then seven or greater than seven. And that's the cohort that we wanted to focus on because that matched very closely to our cohort in study 201-202. Really, the two groups that we wanted that were the most comparable were then boys who had genetic deletions that were amenable to any exon skipping drug, and that was a population of 50 boys. And the most important group was the boys who were amenable to exon 51 skipping with eteplirsen, and this was 13 boys at the baseline. So the first pass that we did is obviously, I think people on the call are familiar with a lot of the work that has been done and really showing a dichotomy of progression based on your age. Those boys that are less than seven continue to actually have a slight improvement over 3 years. Well, the boys that are greater than seven, and this is looking at any genotype, have a very significant decline over 3 years. We then decided to look at a more focused population, boys just with deletions, that were amenable to any exon skipping. And again, the same dichotomy. Boys that were less than seven showed an increase after 3 years, while boys that are seven or greater showed a marked decline over 3 years. And again, so this data suggested that the group that we were identifying was really acting in the same way what was seen in previous reports in the literature. And one of the things that we had found on looking at this data is if we look at all of the various mutations, and in this white line you'll see all mutations. In the blue line, we saw boys that had deletions that were amenable to any exon skipping. And the most severe group were the boys with the deletions that were amenable to exon 51 skipping. Again, consistent to what's been reported in the literature, and the most severe population then that could be compared to our cohort was the exon 51 external control group. So despite the fact that we just used three filters, and again, remind everyone that we included all of the boys who qualified based on age, genetic mutation, and the use of steroids, we were able to compile a group of boys that were quite comparable. This is in regards to age, and if you look at the various age groups, they were very closely matched to our population, both for the exon 51 and for deletions that were amenable to any skipping, but also the baseline six-minute walk test was very close, and we were able to include all of the mutations that were seen in our population and include them in the exon 51 group. So I think we were very pleased that we were able to really identify boys based on the initial filters that were very closely matched to our population. So if we look at this exon 51 population, what we can see when we compare it to the eteplirsen-treated boys, again, is this 151-meter difference between our population that were treated with eteplirsen and between this external control group. Again, suggesting that there was a therapeutic benefit that was seen that was robust. And if we look at all the various different mutations, Again, the robustness of the clinical response suggests that no matter what the mutation was, even including boys that had all mutations, that had point mutations and nonsense mutations, we still saw a benefit in favor of eteplirsen on all these populations. And obviously, the most significant difference was in a population that was closely matched to our group, which is the exon 51 control group. In addition to what we saw for the six-minute walk test, obviously, we wanted to make sure that this was seen, fairly routinely through all of the population. And if we look at the individual patient plots of the external control group, we can see that this population did decline. We had six boys that became non-ambulatory and that declined over 36 months. Now, when we compare this to the eteplirsen treated, again, you can see that there is a difference. We did lose the two boys early. That was at 36 weeks, before 36 weeks, that stopped walking. But again, the rest of the population continued to walk through 36 months. Again, showing that this was not, this difference was not really dictated by a small population, by outliers, but it was a fairly consistent therapeutic response. And again, very importantly, a very hard endpoint that is not effort dependent is the ability to walk. And what we saw is in our population, the eteplirsen treated boys, there were two over 3 years that had stopped walking. But when we look at the external control, what we saw is there was one boy at 12 months, and then three boys at 24 months, but then a total of six boys, or nearly half of the population, stopped walking by 3 years, compared to 17% of boys treated with eteplirsen. And we wanted to demonstrate whether or not this benefit, this clinical benefit that was seen with treatment, could be maintained throughout week 192. So in this particular cohort, we only had 36 months of the external cohort to be able to compare it to. But if we extend out to week 192, so this includes on the dotted line only the boys who had received eteplirsen throughout the entire duration of the study, so then for 4 years of treatment. The previous placebo group was on placebo for the first 6 months, and so they don't have 192. But if we look at patients who had data up to week 192 of treatment, we see, again, that there was a very good stability of the decline that had occurred between then 168 and 192. So the pulmonary function was an important aspect of the clinical experience that the FDA had asked us to look at. We could not identify a cohort that had patient-level data, but if we look at our eteplirsen-treated boys through 4 years at 192 weeks, we can see that MIP and MEP percent predicted remained relatively stable again through 4 years. And we could only compare this to the natural history and primarily focusing on the Synergy database, where we saw typically between a 4 and 5% decline between MIP and MEP percent predicted. So again, suggesting that there was a therapeutic effect that did affect respiratory function over 4 years. So just to summarize our efficacy data, really the focus has been that at 3 years we could see a difference of 151 meters, comparing it to an external control group that was as closely matched as we could to our group, and that most, even more importantly, it was the proportion who lost ambulation, and that the eteplirsen-treated boys, it was 17 versus 46% to the control group. And then finally, the pulmonary data suggests a relative stability of MIP and MEP percent predicted over 3 years compared to the medical literature. So turning on towards the fourth biopsy, obviously this has been an important aspect that the FDA has asked us to look at. And basically, could the drug function as we expect and produce dystrophin based on the mechanism of action? And so the background on this is that 11 of the 12 patients who are still enrolled in the study had agreed to this voluntary surgical biopsy. Importantly, we spent a number of months working with the FDA to make sure that the protocols were appropriate and that this included the number of controls, the blinding, to make sure that it was done in a method that would be considered appropriate by the FDA. We focus on the measurement, basically measuring the mechanism of action through RT-PCR, and then again on dystrophin expression. And this was done by a number of different ways, looking at percent dystrophin positive fibers, dystrophin signal intensity in the Western blot. And all of these were performed in a blinded, randomized manner by four independent pathologists. And again, we were really focused on making sure that we could demonstrate the presence of dystrophin. I think in our discussions with the FDA, it was agreed that we could not use this as a qualified biomarker that would predict clinical benefit. But I think the FDA, and they have stated this in their draft guidance, on DMD approval mechanisms, is that proving the mechanism of action is very supportive data that the drug is working as we expect. So when we look at this, again, trying to confirm the mechanism of action for exon skipping by RT-PCR, we saw that all of the boys, that 11 out of 11, showed the appropriate skip transcript, and this was confirmed by sequencing to show that it was done at the exact location. And this data is consistent to what we've seen in the past, that all patients previously treated with eteplirsen had evidence of appropriate exon skipping by RT-PCR. Next, we focused on percent positive fibers. And we had agreed with the FDA, because we didn't have baseline data on these patients, that we would use boys with DMD that had the appropriate genetic mutation that was amenable to exon skipping. If you look at the right-hand slide of the slide, you can see that 9 boys showed very low levels of dystrophin untreated. However, if we look at 10 out of the 11 boys that were treated after 180 weeks of eteplirsen treatment, we could see that except for one patient, everyone showed exon skipping and showed dystrophin-positive fibers. We'll focus on patient 11, and just to show an example of all of the slides on the left of this particular boy, again, it was very consistent exon skipping with dystrophin-positive fibers, and this is compared to low levels of dystrophin expression that was seen in the untreated control group. So here are the numerical quantification, and again, this was looking at percent positive fibers compared to the controls. And the primary analysis was done by a neuromuscular pathologist at Nationwide Children's Hospital. And what we could see was a very statistically significant difference to the untreated group. And this was an increase of 641%. And this was confirmed by 3 general pathologists who were trained to look for dystrophin-positive fibers. And they also confirmed that they had seen over 1,000% increase over the untreated control group. And again, we had worked with the FDA to try to control all of the variables, and that all of the pathologists had the same type of screen, display, as far as for intensity and other factors were identical. The ambient light was controlled with a light meter. So anything that we could do to make sure that the pathologists were reading these images in the same fashion, we did try to control with. And so again, it shows that the 4 pathologists did confirm the presence of percent positive fibers compared to the untreated control. And again, if we look at the intensity, this was done by a computer algorithm where the computer read the image, again showing a very consistent increase in the intensity in the treated group compared to the untreated group. And so, and then, of course, there was a wanted to confirm also by Western blot, could we actually see the presence of dystrophin? And I think the reason why we were interested in the Western blot is that it has been the primary diagnostic tool prior to the introduction of genetic testing. And really, typically, the absence of a band or very low levels of a band was confirmatory for a Duchenne muscular dystrophy, while the presence of a clear presence of a band, even though it was reduced, typically a shortened band because it's an in-frame deletion, that was diagnostic for a Becker muscular dystrophy. And what we were able to demonstrate in our Western blot gels is that 9 out of the 11 boys had a clearly observable dystrophin band. And only in one boy was there any evidence of a dystrophin band in the untreated control group. So again, suggesting that the treatment really confirmed the presence of the appropriate sized and molecular weight protein based on the genetic mutation, and it was present in these boys. And here's an example of one boy who we did have some baseline tissue available. And at the baseline, which was untreated, in line 8 on the left, you can see there was no band. But after 180 weeks, what we can see is a clear disfavored band using the DIS-1 antibody. Also, I think just to mention that the FDA did request that we do this in a very rigorous fashion. So it was done in duplicate gels. We had the standard curve, and for every gel, we used positive and negative controls. We quantified very specific levels of protein per lane and make sure that it wasn't overloaded, and the exposure time was controlled to 30 minutes. And despite these fairly conservative methodologies, we were able, again, to see in 9 of the 11 patients the presence of a band. And so just to summarize this, looking at the fourth biopsy, all of the patients showed the appropriate exon skipping by RT-PCR. We showed the dystrophin intensity that was statistically significant. And again, this was an automated quantification system that looked at the level of intensity at the sarcolemma. The percent positive fibers were, again, confirmed by 4 blinded independent pathologists compared to the untreated control group. And finally, the Western blot showed 9 out of 11 boys that had the presence of a band, where only one of the DMD untreated control group could show any evidence of dystrophin on the Western band. So finally, in looking at the biopsies, we were also asked by the FDA to look at the rescore and the percent dystrophin-positive fibers in Study 201. And what I'll remind people is that was our primary endpoint at week 24. This was the blinded portion of the study. And one of the criticisms that the FDA had is it was only done by one blinded pathologist, but it did meet the primary endpoint at week 24 in the 30 milligram per kilogram dose of an increase that was statistically significant in percent dystrophin-positive fibers. So what the focus of this rescore was is could 3 independent pathologists who were trained to do this, and again, general pathologists, not neuromuscular experts, but could they confirm the presence of dystrophin? And when this was performed, if you recall, at week 12, we did not see dystrophin, and the 3 pathologists then confirmed that there was no dystrophin production. But at week 24, there was a statistically significant increase in dystrophin that was confirmed by these 3 pathologists. And again, one of the requirements that we were asked to by the FDA is we had to demonstrate both inter and intra-rater reliability, which showed a good level of concordance among these 3 pathologists. Again, this just confirmed what we had already seen, but again, giving more evidence that the dystrophin production was in fact robust. And finally, I'll focus on the safety. And I think, as people know, one of the concerns has been we've had a small data set, only 12 patients. But one of the things we've been able to do is to really supplement our data set and have a larger data set that was very consistent with what we've seen with the 201-202 study. So initially we had, of course, our 12 patients that have now over 4 years of exposure to eteplirsen. But what we've done is we've included boys from some of our newer studies from 301 and 204. These include older boys that are up to 21 years of age. And we have 12 additional patients that have between 12 and 24 weeks data of exposure, and then 22 patients that have less than 12 weeks, for a total of 72 patients that have been exposed. So again, I think what we've tried to do is really increase the number of patients so that we can confirm if there are any differences to what we saw with the original 12-patient cohort. And what we've seen is that most of really the adverse events were mild and unrelated to the study drug. And this is similar to what we saw in 201-202. And also, we've really looked, to look at what are the side effects that appear to be related to the drug. And so far, what we've seen have included reactions such as flushing or erythema and mild temperature elevation. But more importantly, the FDA had asked us, can we look for adverse events of special interest that have been seen with other antisense oligonucleotides, and especially with the phosphorothioates? So we did look very carefully at a lot of different organs, specifically looking for hepatic toxicity, renal toxicity, coagulation problems, cutaneous reactions. in things such as thrombocytopenia or hematologic abnormalities. And we did not see these events of special interest that have been seen with other phosphorothioates. And really, just to review, at week 192, we have now over 2,300 boys who've been administered dose. Majority of the missed doses have actually been related to planned family vacations, and we tried to dose around the vacations to make it easier for the families. We haven't had any missed doses due to drug-related adverse events. We have no drug-related serious adverse events. And we've not seen the need to have any intermittent dosing or drug holidays or dose reductions or discontinuations. And importantly, there's been no hospitalizations related to adverse events due to drug. And the most common adverse events related to drug were mild, and really included flushing and erythema and mild temperature elevation. But overall, the common AEs were mild and were thought to be unrelated to study drug. One of the important things that we've wanted to follow is there had been concern is could any therapy exacerbate the underlying cardiac disease? So we did follow these boys for over 192, and we did not see any decline in the systolic ejection fracture over 192 weeks. So there was, in fact, a slight increase of 1.49% that we saw. And again, this is just not to refer to the efficacy, but really pointing out the safety that we didn't see any evidence of cardiomyopathy worsening. And so just to reiterate the totality of the data, you know, our focus has been on making sure that we collect clinical efficacy. And the best way to do that, since we were unable to do a three-year placebo-controlled trial, was to try to find a cohort of patients that were closely compared to our cohort. And we showed, you know, that there was 151 meters over 3 years. We also showed, over 3 years, pulmonary stability in regards to MIP and MET percent predicted. And again, trying to supply further supportive efficacy measurements is really the biochemical efficacy. And what we were trying to demonstrate is that by a number of different measurements, you know, over 4 years, we continue to see dystrophin-positive fibers. We see an increase in intensity. We see the RT-PCR positive in every single patient. And we see the Western blot that was confirmed in 9 out of 11 patients. And then even on the rescore, confirming results from weeks 12 and 24, we saw, again, a consistent increase in percent dystrophin-positive fibers. And finally, that after, you know, including a larger number of patients, we could see that over 2,300 doses, we didn't see any new indication or safety signals that was different from what we saw with the 201-202 study. So looking forward, where we want to go, you know, obviously, you know, we have been focused certainly over the last several months on eteplirsen approval, but wanted to really make sure that we are committed to this. And we're doing two confirmatory studies after discussions with the FDA. We have now four clinical trials ongoing. We will have over 100 patients enrolled once the trials are fully enrolled. And we will be extending really our focus also into Europe. We're going to be meeting with the EMA later this year, and we'll be hiring key personnel in the U.S. to really look at our European strategy. Also, we're continuing our studies in 53 and 45. We have clinical trials underway in Europe and soon in the U.S. looking at both these new drugs. And also, we made a commitment to the community to really develop other exons. So our aspiration is for 8 exons into the clinic by 2018. We have, you know, we're going to be working with the FDA and the EMA to really identify a shorter approval path for these rare mutations. And we have preclinical work for exon 55, 52, 50, 35, and 8. And we're also doing collaborations for exon 2 duplications. And again, we're really looking at the total pictures of boys with Duchenne muscular dystrophy. And our focus is not only exon skipping, but we're really interested in any disease-modifying therapy that we can help boys with Duchenne's muscular dystrophy. And obviously, we're also interested in other genetic diseases. We have programs now in spinal muscular atrophy, and you'll, for those people here in Brighton at the World Muscle Society, Steve Wilton will be presenting some really interesting data on Pompe disease, the late onset Pompe disease. So again, We're really doubling down on our focus for rare genetic diseases, especially in the neuromuscular space. But we were really looking forward to eteplirsen as our first foothold in this area. So thanks, everybody. And now what I'd like to open up to some of our panel members to really help, you know, maybe put this in perspective. And I'll ask Dr. Wilton, can you, based on your own personal experience, can you comment on the data?
Look, thanks, Ed. That was really impressive. I mean, one of the things that people might be concerned about is that two boys didn't respond with dystrophin. And why is that? Now, before I answer that, you've just shown data that shows that most of the boys did respond and they make dystrophin. Now, in my opinion, and from what's been published and reported, this is the only dystrophin-restoring treatment that I've seen is that it's actually making more dystrophin after treatment than beforehand. Why the two boys didn't respond, there's several different reasons for that, possibly the quality of the biopsies, the little muscle, and the assays you're doing are very, very conservative. The nature of the deletion breakpoint's another possibility. We just heard a talk this morning about modifiers of genetic modifiers in a person's background that'll influence it. Another rare possibility is a second mutation that can knock it out. But finally, this is the first therapeutic compound that has increased dystrophin expression. Steroids have been around for a long time, and there's still discussions over how they are best used. You've got one treatment you've been following, a weekly administration of one dose. There's so many ways of improving this, but this is the first therapeutic compound that's making dystrophin. So stop there.
Thanks, Steve. And we have Ann Connolly who's with us today. And based on your experience, because I know you have a wealth of experience in boys with DMD, what's your personal experience, clinical experience, in regards to the pulmonary data? And just want to get your overall viewpoint of that.
So the pulmonary data to me is very impressive for a couple of reasons. First, the boys, even before they stop walking, it's very clear from several papers in the last 2 years and data I have from a collaborative effort in the United States that those boys are supposed to decrease not only pulmonary function, which was followed for many, many years, but now more recently, MIP and MEP. So the fact that they did not decline, even in the two non-ambulatory boys who came off their feet very quickly, was very strong data for me. The other extremely obvious point is that boys who are entering the study at 10 or 11 are not supposed to continue to walk for 3 or 4 years, even with most doses of most good treatment with steroids. That's a rare outcome. We didn't know it when the study started, but we all do now know it because of Dr. McCurry's work, that this is a bad mutation. This subset of boys, on average, does worse than other deletions in the same general area. So it's the most common deletion, which is why it was thought to treat first. But now we know what we didn't know 3 or 4 years ago, is that it is also one of the worst mutations. And Dr. McCurry could certainly address that point more, better than I could.
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously we have worked very closely with Dr. Eugenio McCurry to look at the natural history. And he clearly has some of the largest experience with natural history in Duchenne muscular dystrophy. And Dr. McCurry, you know, could you just comment on, you know, based on your experience with the natural history, does it appear that the boys treated with eteplirsen are behaving differently from what you'd expect to see on your experience in boys with DMD, especially with the exon 51 population?
Yes, they do behave differently, and it's quite compelling to see that this is not just one isolated case or an outlier which makes the difference. I found very compelling that all the children, with the exception of the two who lost ambulation immediately after treatment, remained nearly stable over a very long duration. And from our experience on natural history, is that when children start above the age of 7, even the children who have better mutations than one amenable for 51 will hardly remain stable. We have seen isolated cases, but this is not what we see normally. So it's very compelling to see that the consistency of the data, of the stability of the data, and the other data are very compelling, is that with the exception of the two who lost ambulation immediately, none of the others lost ambulation. And this is very important because we know from our experience and from the literature that loss of ambulation is also important, because if we can delay loss of ambulation, we will also delay all the other sequelae, from respiratory to self-feeding up to survival. So they are definitely behaving differently and in a good way.
Sure. Thanks, Dr. McCurry. Dr. Perry Shea is actually the largest enroller for our 301 study, so Dr. Shea has a lot of experience. And Dr. Shea, maybe, again, based on your experience, what's your feeling as far as the safety overall on some of the patients that you've been treating with eteplirsen?
Yeah, so among all the studies that I've been participating in, we've been dosing 9 patients. And really, this is consistent. I've not seen really any treatment-related adverse events at all in any of our patients. They've really tolerated it well. We've been looking very carefully for anything that could possibly be, hematologic, any type of renal changes. And these patients are really just tolerating this medication just fine. It's really quite satisfying to see that.
Thanks, Dr. Shea. And finally, Dr. Jerry Mendell probably has more experience in Duchenne muscular dystrophy than anybody else in the room, and really has been a leading researcher for a lot of different therapies. And Dr. Mendell, I would just like to ask, what's your overall personal experience? What's your feeling with the eteplirsen, and what are some of the things that you're personally seeing? Because obviously you've been involved with many boys with this, and just to give some thoughts, high level thoughts about your personal experience with boys treated with the eteplirsen.
Thank you, Ed. I think put this in historical perspective is important. The biggest shift that we had in the natural history of Duchenne dystrophy was the addition of steroids, and we added. From boys losing ambulation probably between 9 and 11 to a shift to 12 to 14 or 12 to 13, adding 1 to 2 years. Now remember that this data was compared directly with Dr. McCurry data on ambulation in boys who were on steroids. So now we have a further shift, a loss of 151 meters compared to, a significant improvement, a reduction in loss of 151 meters in the eteplirsen group compared to the steroid group. And if you think about that in overall terms, again, I think the historical perspective as we see the disease evolve over many years is that remaining ambulatory is a critical point. And 151 meters means that these boys will be able to stay ambulatory for a longer period of time. Well, what does that mean? That means that, one, we prevent scoliosis. If we prevent scoliosis, we prevent compromise of diaphragmatic function. If we preserve respiratory function, as Dr. Conley mentioned, then what we see is less stress on the heart, and the ultimate a goal, of course, is that if we do all of those things and cascade those things in the order that I said, we can preserve life for a longer period in the Duchenne population.
Okay. Thanks, Dr. Mendell. Now I'd like to open it up to questions.
Thank you. At this time, if you have a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone to ask a question. Our first question comes from the line of Brian Scorney of Robert Baird. Your line is open.
Hey, good morning, guys. Congrats on the data. I was looking through the slides, and particularly on the dystrophin, I was hoping, maybe you could answer a couple questions. Maybe Dr. Wilton could even give some insight on this. Just in terms of the disparity in the scoring of Nationwide Children's and the other pathologists, it looks like the actual quantification's pretty different. Help me understand, you know, why the pathologists are having such different quantification on the percent positive fibers on immunohistochemistry, and also in terms of the actual scoring on whether it's net positive or negative. So to say 10 of 11 were positive, how do you reach consensus on that? Is that four scores have to be positive or three of four, and how do you determine negativity versus positivity there? Thanks.
Sure. Thanks, Brian. You know, just to talk about the difference between the Nationwide neuromuscular pathologists and the other pathologists, I think it's a matter of experience. So the pathologist at Nationwide Children is a pathologist who's been doing this for decades, a number of clinical trials, as an expert in reading biopsy slides, looking for dystrophin. And obviously the sensitivity of that pathologist is going to be greater. The focus really of what the FDA had requested on us was not really to come up with a number, but really to make sure that we could get three independent pathologists who were trained. Could they also basically show a statistically significant difference? So I think it's really the difference between a neuromuscular expert and three general pathologists. But I think the importance of it is really to confirm that the dystrophin was there, and it wasn't just seen by a single center, but it was confirmed by now four independent pathologists. So the scores that we're talking about were based on all of the scores of the four pathologists. And what the general pathologists were trained, they had an agreement on how they would read it as far as what percent of the fiber had to be present, and they trained for a week prior to reading this. And again, there was a lot of controls as far as the making sure that the images were done in the same way, that the display monitor was set at the standard, the ambient light was the same. So again, the focus of the three pathologists was to confirm it. And we didn't expect them to be able to have the same sensitivity as the neuromuscular pathologist. So I think that probably explains the situation. And then I think in regards to, I think Steve, I think you've commented before just about the Western and some of the differences. What I'll remind you that even though the one patient, as an example, who we didn't see dystrophin at the week 180, we did see dystrophin that was present at 48 weeks. But again, as Steve was explaining, and he can go over it again, we do see a lot of sampling variability in the biopsies, and so it's not surprising that there may be some differences from one biopsy to another. Steve?
Yeah, absolutely. I mentioned that the assays you were doing were very conservative, putting 50 micrograms of total protein on per lane. Now, that's very different to what's happened in the other studies where between 300 and 500 micrograms of protein are loaded per lane versus a 1 microgram control. So if you had equivalent bands of dystrophin on the Western blot, that's corresponding to a roughly 0.3% dystrophin. And that's after treatment in some cases. So that's not showing any increase in dystrophin. You've got a pre-treatment and a post-treatment. There is a clear increase in the dystrophin on the Western blot. And I mean, one of the things that we've seen, not only just we've published, this is in the Journal of Gene Medicine 2006, the Dutch group published in Journal of Gene Medicine 2009, head-to-head comparisons of 2-O-methyl chemistry and the morpholino. There's at least an order of magnitude difference in exon skipping efficiency. The morpholino, the PMO, is 10 times better. That's not just our experience, which we published, but it's from other labs as well.
And just in terms of the scoring of positive negative, so when you say 10 of 11 biopsies were positive for dystrophin, positive fibers versus none in the controls, is that saying was there consensus among all the pathologists for those scores? So is
yes.
Four of four saying that 10 were positive and one was negative?
Yeah, no, so that was basically all the pathologists were in agreement on the scoring. So there was very consistent agreement. You know, again, the absolute scores varied somewhat, but again, they were all going in the same direction. There was very good correlation between the three pathologists. So, yeah, this was concordance with all four of the pathologists that scored that.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Demos Simonides of RBC Capital Markets. Your line is open.
Good morning, guys. Congratulations on this data. It looks very good. I have a question. If you were to break out the 30 mg dose, how do the data look? Do you still, or rather, where's the delta with the match control, given that this is going to be the dose you're going to be going forward with?
So, you know, one of the things, of course, that we were asked also by the FDA is how did we determine the dose? And since it is a small study, we had chosen a pharmacodynamic marker to choose the dose, and that was really looking at 30 versus 50 and comparing the two populations. And we did not see any statistically significant difference between 30 and 50, and in fact, numerically, the 30 was slightly higher. So the dose of 30 was really based on the pharmacodynamic marker of no difference in dystrophin expression. You know, obviously, if we just look at the population that remained ambulatory, again, we couldn't really see a difference in walking ability or other functional activity based on the dose. It seemed fairly comparable. Also, the adverse event rate was very similar. So, because we really wanted to make sure that you know, we're being fairly conservative, we didn't want to go in with a higher dose for a lifelong therapy unless there was a clear benefit. And since we didn't see any benefit of 50 over 30 based on the pharmacodynamic markers, we chose a lower dose of 30 milligrams per kilogram.
So if you were to look at the graph between your match control of 13 patients and the patients that were taking the 30 mg dose on the eteplirsen, what would the delta there be?
Well, again, the challenge, of course, is remember that we don't have an equivalent number because we have the two boys that stopped ambulation. So, you know, their value was the last observation carried forward, which was at zero. But if we look at the boys who remained ambulatory, there wasn't any significant differences between the 30 and 50 as far as their six-minute walk test differences. So, you know, obviously the 50 did better because we had more boys that were still walking, you know, because of the two boys were in the 30 milligram per kilogram. But if we just look at the population that remained ambulatory, we didn't really see any differences, and we saw the same magnitude of effect between 30 and 50 compared to the external control group.
Okay, and then the fourth biopsy had a pretty impressive dystrophin expression. When you showed the rescoring of the first biopsy that was done, it was statistically significant, but the magnitude seemed to be you know, smaller than what we saw in the fourth biopsy, and I assume that given that you used the completely different methodologies in the fourth biopsy versus the first three, was that the reason for the change for the big difference in magnitude?
Well, I think as I had explained previously, I think you know, the purpose of the rescore was just to confirm that there was a statistically significant increase in the dystrophin, and it was observed by more than one observer. I think the differences in the absolute values are related to really the experience of the pathologist. And again, remember, the higher scores were recorded by a very experienced neuromuscular pathologist, and what we saw from the general pathologist, we didn't see as high a readings, but it was a very consistent reading, There was good concordance among the three readers, and they all demonstrated that it was a very definitive, statistically significant increase. So the purpose of those three readers was just to confirm what we saw in the fourth. And, you know, we certainly appreciate that someone who has decades of experience is probably going to be more attuned to pick up small differences in the dystrophin expression, and I think that's why we're seeing some of the magnitude changes. But I think the important take-home message is that it confirms it. No matter who read the biopsies, they were all in the same direction, and they reached statistical significance.
A final question, I'll jump back into queue. How involved were, I guess, the FDA people that were advising you, or, you know, another way to ask this was, you know, were you able to follow what the FDA had said in how you you conducted the fourth biopsy?
Yeah, so I think it was very, you know, I think the discussions that we've had with the FDA have been very productive. And I mean by that, I think they've helped take a very small data set and try to supplement it and try to make it more informative and more robust. So in addition to, you know, the request for the external control group that they really wanted to look at the effect of treatment for over, you know, now 4 years, but specifically for 3 years compared to an external control group, they worked with us very closely in regards to the dystrophin expression. And the reason why they were focused on it is they wanted to, again, have another supplemental data piece that suggests that the drug was working as expected. So, you know, we had a lot of discussions with them on all of the various aspects for the reread, how the blinding would be done, what controls were necessary. For the Western blot, they were very interested in making sure we had standard curves, regimented amount of protein, that we made that the exposure time was identical, that we had all the blinding that was done, randomization that was done. So every aspect of the protocols we had discussed in detail with the FDA, and this really took months to go through and make sure that they were comfortable. And I think what we tried to do is to really follow their direction, and they had an opportunity to review all of our protocols prior to the analyses that were done.
That's great. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Tim Lugo of William Blair. Your line is open.
Thanks for taking the question. Congratulations on the data. Can you maybe give us some more color on the renal safety observed from the complete safety data set you presented? I know in the past there were some questions if proteinuria observed was drug-related or not. And just any color you can give us on that.
Certainly. And what I can do is ask you know, some of my colleagues here to comment on what they've seen as far as the safety. You know, I think, you know, what we did is we were very interested in renal toxicity, again, because some of the renal toxin proteinuria that has been observed with a lot of treatments with phosphorothioates. So what we have done is we've looked at serum cystatin C, we've looked at KIM-1, kidney injury molecule 1, for proximal tubular damage, and we looked at overall renal function. And the only thing that we have seen is very occasional proteinuria. And again, this proteinuria is typically 1+, and not only two occasions did we see 2+ protein. And most of the time, these resolve spontaneous within the next visit. And so if we look at all of the various urines that we've looked at, 97% of these are free of any protein. And when we do see it, it doesn't appear to be dose-related. It doesn't it occurs spontaneously. We've seen it at the same frequency that we saw in the placebo group. Many of these have also occurred pre-treatment. So we're really not seeing a significant proteinuria that we feel is related to the drug. It doesn't get worse the longer the treatment is given. But you know, maybe I'll ask Dr. Shea and then Dr. Mandel to comment on what they've seen, if they've seen any evidence of renal toxicity.
Yeah, so what I've been seeing, I mean, I don't have much to say because we really haven't seen any effects because it's... I've not seen any proteinuria among any of my patients so far. So it's
Dr. Connolly?
I would say that prior to active clinical trials, we never tested the urine of any boy with Duchenne dystrophy. But now involved in many, many studies of Duchenne boys at baseline before they're ever in the study, there are occasional episodes of proteinuria, but in the two lads that have been followed at my site for now 2, 3, 4 years, plus the children in the 301 study, I've never had a urine that was abnormal more than one time, and then we did nothing and it went away. So the presumption has been that those are unrelated when the decision is made about, you know, if you have proteinuria once and the child hasn't had it then for another year and then he has it once, that it's very, very rare. And now that we do other studies, we do know occasionally boys with Duchenne have some protein in their urine.
And Dr. Mandel, you've got the most long-term experience with treating boys with eteplirsen. Any comments on if you're seeing any signals as far as any proteinuria or renal toxicity?
Again, in a historical perspective, I've been doing clinical trials for over 40 years, and I have never participated in a clinical study where we didn't see adverse events. This is the only trial I have ever been involved in, and it's incredibly remarkable that we haven't had a single adverse event nor a single significant adverse event. So it's quite impressive and very gratifying and makes you feel very comfortable in recruiting new patients to this type of exon skipping with a PMO.
Thanks, Dr. Mandel.
Well, that was some great color, and thank you to the physicians for...
Great.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Chad Messer of Needham & Co. Your line is open.
Great. Thanks for taking my question, and thanks for the presentation. I appreciate the tremendous amount of hard work that went into collecting all this data. Have you guys looked for correlations between any of the measures of dystrophin and, you know, either 6-minute walk or pulmonary function, any of the functional outcomes, whether it's patients over time or between the patient groups?
Yeah, no, that's a good question, and you know, we have looked at this to see if we can correlate the dystrophin to things like 6-minute walk or other indications. But I think, you know, if we put this in perspective, this has really never been done very well with Becker, which is, of course, a much larger experience trying to correlate dystrophin level. So we've been focused on, you know, really the presence or absence of dystrophin and making sure that the drug is working as expected. But I'm going to let Dr. Mercuri, who has a lot of experience really in boys with Becker, you know, about your experience, about how well does the dystrophin correlate with functional outcome?
Of course, the presence of dystrophin correlates with a better outcome, but not necessarily the quantity of it. There are published data on Becker's and also from our personal experience where we cannot really find a linear relationship between the amount of dystrophin found on biopsy and the functional level, because the functional level is really the results of many other factors like weight, height, and many other factors which will contribute. So in practical terms, what we do in clinics is that when we have a new diagnosis, when we see more than traces of dystrophin, we are always more optimistic on the outcome. So I would agree that going for a definition that dystrophin is there is already an important point, and that we cannot expect a linear correlation between levels of dystrophin and function.
Okay, great. I mean, you know, maybe as we get more sophisticated and collect more data, we'll be able to see more of a relationship there. Thank you.
Can I add one thing on that, Ed? I think it's important for our listeners to appreciate that we're really talking about body-wide dystrophin here and not a single local site where we do a biopsy following 12, 24, 36, or 192 weeks, or 168 weeks of treatment, plus the fact that we're looking at biceps in studies 201 and 202, deltoid at the end of the first year trial, and then quadriceps at the end of 168 weeks. So I think this kind of comparative data, if we had a biomarker that allowed us to look at body-wide distribution with eteplirsen, we may see something a little bit more revealing.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Debjit Chattopadhyay of Roth Capital Partners. Your line is open.
Hey, good morning. Can you hear me?
Good morning, Debjit. Yes, we can hear you.
Great. Well, most of my questions have been answered, and the one that I'm looking for is basically throwing into the esteemed panel here. Given the limitations of current therapeutic regimens for DMD and the limitations of this data set, and the safety profile of eteplirsen so far, do you think this drug merits approval, merits a conditional approval while the studies are currently ongoing? Thank you.
Okay. So if I think I heard your question correctly, really does the data set from this small study merit really approval for an accelerated approval pathway? Clearly, you know, that is the question that the FDA is going to answer. And they have to be able to review the totality of the data and make that decision. I think, though, really over the last 2 years, what we've been able to do is to really supplement a small data set. And this is with the clinical efficacy of the six-minute walk test by, you know, comparing it. So it's no longer a 12-patient study, but closer to what would be a 25-patient study where we took 12 treated patients, compared it to 13 untreated patients over 3 years. And so that really improves the data set significantly. The other thing I think what we've been focused on is we do have other data. We have North Star Ambulatory Assessment that we've included. We have pulmonary data. Obviously, the other thing we've really focused on is the presence definitively of dystrophin. And we've looked at a number of different measures. And, you know, we've made sure that the dystrophin is in the right location, that is, it has an increase in intensity, that we have dystrophin-positive fibers, that 100% of the patients who are exon 51 skippable do have evidence of the appropriate transcript on messenger RNA. And we confirm the 9 of the 11 patients on Western blot. So again, suggesting that the drug is working as it should. We assume it's supposed to be making dystrophin. We demonstrated that the dystrophin is there. And then finally, you know, we believe that there is a reasonable safety profile based on the information we have. And finally, we're going to confirm the efficacy and safety of this drug by not one but two confirmatory studies. So I think we're really in this for the long haul, and I think that really the question is for the physicians, you know, is it better for the patients to receive the drug earlier, or should we wait another couple of years for the results of all the confirmatory studies? And I think if we look at this as a company, we think the time is now. You know, we've been doing this work since 2007. You know, we think we have enough evidence that it would warrant an accelerated approval. But obviously, that's a decision that only the FDA can make. And what we've tried to do is give them all the information we can. But what I'm going to go around the room, and I'm really going to ask you know, our colleagues here, I think it's more important, rather than what does the company think, what do they think? And I'm going to start out with Steve Wilton and then go around the group. Do you think that we have enough data here that it's reasonable to give an accelerated approval?
Yes. I mean, I made the comment some time ago, it's bleeding obvious. You're making dystrophin. Dystrophin is being made, you're seeing a benefit in the patients. And withholding it from other people, it's morally wrong.
Dr. Mendel, any comments?
I think you couldn't show a slide, but you emphasized it in your answer. The primary outcome was the 6-minute walk test. But if you look across the board and you compare three groups, a steroid untreated group, a steroid treated group, and an eteplirsen treated group, there are differences in not only the primary outcome in the 6-minute walk, there's differences in every functional secondary outcome. That means the North Star Ambulatory, the time to arise from a chair, the time to arise from sitting, and then you emphasize the pulmonary functions and the fact that all this correlates is corroborated by making the biomarker dystrophin. I don't see how you can deny boys as they come into the clinic treatment with this agent.
Dr. McCurry, any thoughts?
Well, I can only echo what the other colleagues have said. I mean, as a clinician, I can, you know, trying to address the question whether we can wait 2 years to see more results, is that as a clinician, I can say that 2 years in untreated children could make the difference between going from ambulant to non-ambulant. And in this disease, the goal is really to have a treatment that is available as early as possible. So for all the reasons that have been said, dystrophin and all the other endpoints go in the same direction, I would be, you know, very supportive of this.
Dr. Conley?
I certainly absolutely agree. And I also, by chance, have been following two of the very oldest boys in the study. One of them I sent to Dr. Mendel when he was 11, and he's now 15. And at age 11, I have a video of him just barely able to get off the floor. So he is still walking quite well, taking driver's ed, and he will be the first Duchenne boy I have who's taking driver's ed without any modification on his car. And the second young man did break a leg midway into it, and it was an adverse, unrelated event. But often breaking a leg means you stop walking with Duchenne, and he got right back up after he was sort of put to rest, as you would for about 8 weeks, and then he was able to get back up. So those type of little incidental views and the complete data set are very compelling to me. And as Dr. Mendel said, it's a very easy trial to try to recruit additional boys as young as possible, as soon as possible. It is the first screen I do when I think about a clinical trial for a boy. It's the first thing I look at before recommending any clinical trial.
Good. And Dr. Shea, any comments?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think the clinical efficacy is quite remarkable. You really don't need the statistics when you see patients that are walking this far out, but, you know, you've really presented a rigorous full intent to treat analysis of the data. You've shown biopsy data that the eteplirsen is partially restored in the muscle of these boys. It tells a complete story that eteplirsen corrects the reading frame of dystrophin transcripts. Dystrophin expression is restored, and this results in improved muscle function of Duchenne boys when compared to typical Duchenne boys that we all see in our clinical experience. The minimal adverse events really that don't appear to be drug-related really makes the risk-benefit equation attractive for this drug. And in my opinion, this data really provides the kind of data and analysis that makes clinicians and patients confident about this drug and its effects.
Okay. Thanks, Dr. Shea.
Thank you. Thank you so much to the panel, and good luck going forward.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from the line of Chris Marari of Oppenheimer. Your line is open.
Hi, guys. This is actually Michelle on for Chris. But we were wondering what muscle group the fourth biopsy was taken from and which muscle group the control was taken from?
As you recall, the first two biopsies were alternating biceps. The last two were deltoid. And so the control groups consisted of biceps, but also a couple of patients who had deltoid. So it was a mixed population. So we did have some deltoid controls that were included.
All right, great. And we were also just wondering what happened to the patient that did not show dystrophin in the clinic.
Okay, so that particular boy did show dystrophin at week 48 following a biopsy, but the boy is still ambulatory and continues to walk. So that boy, you know, and hasn't developed any other complications in upper extremities or pulmonary function. So still is performing, but obviously on this most recent biopsy, we did see the dystrophin. But we're not seeing any marked dramatic clinical differences yet.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Evan Seigerman of Deutsche Bank. Your line is open.
Hi, guys. Thank you so much for taking my question, and really congrats on the update. Can you hear me all right? I hear some feedback on the line.
Yes, we can hear you fine.
Okay, perfect. I just want to make sure. So, you know, I have a question as it relates to some of the patent issues that we heard about earlier this week. So when I, you know, look at the situation, it seems that there's two interferences going on, one relating to the comp of matter and one relating to a method of use. And then in the press release that you guys put out earlier this week, you said that your key patents for eteplirsen were not involved in these disputes. But it's my understanding that the comp of matter is pretty important. So can you help me just understand what's going on here so I have a better picture?
Well, my first caveat is I'm a physician and scientist, and I'm a lousy lawyer. But what
okay,
I can
fair
say,
enough.
But what I can say is that you know we are focused obviously on the clinical and scientific aspects. You know, I think, as you know, patent law is very complicated. And what's been, you know, what was reported this week, it's really was a method patent. It doesn't address the two substantial claims of composition of matter. So this is a long process. There's a lot of discussions that will continue to go on, and whatever happens, it'll be held up in the courts under appeal for a while. So I think, you know, our focus is really making sure that we have the science and the clinical efficacy down pat. And I think really a lot of the patent issues have become a distraction. You know, we're really focused on the science and the clinical medicine, and we have very good lawyers that are helping us with the patent issues. So that's what we're focusing on.
No, excellent. Thanks for taking my question. I appreciate it. And I definitely, you know, see the importance of the clinical data versus some of the patent distraction. Thanks
Great.
Again.
Thanks.
Our next question comes from Lisa Bako of JMP Securities. Your line is open.
Hi. Thank you for taking the question and congratulations on the data set.
Good morning, Lisa.
I wanted to ask a little bit more about the natural history data you collected. Could you maybe tell us the one was the Italian telephone, and I think it's the National Medical Research Council that collected the others. Are these subjects that are included in these databases? Do they include some U.S. patients, or are they where are they located? I guess my question.
Sure. Well, Dr. McCurry, who's here, has the largest data set. The other data set was from Dr. Natalie Gomez. So I'll let Dr. McCurry talk about his data.
Our study is a prospective natural history study, which started 7 years ago approximately, and it includes a network with all the tertiary care neuromuscular centers in Italy. So in practical terms, all the Duchenne boys who have a diagnosis should be referred to a tertiary care center. We have no strict exclusion criteria, or let's say we have no many exclusion criteria because we try to get as many boys as we can. The only exclusion criteria was that the kids did not have behavioral or severe cognitive impairment, which would affect their understanding or the performance of the test. All the other kids were included. We didn't exclude anyone else, and they are collected according to a fixed form, and we followed the same instructions that were followed in the study, because since 2007, I think, we have all been following the same manual and the same instructions of the six-minute walk test and of the other tests that have been followed also in clinical trials. And another element which may help to appreciate how consistent our data could be is that we compared our database and the Belgian database with some data from the U.S. and from other European countries, and the slope of deterioration in our natural history data were really identical, more than similar, were really identical. And another point of strength where I think our database can be used as a good control is that our physiotherapist, who is the main author in many of the papers, was training all the Italian centers, but she was also part of the trainers of many of the international studies on Duchenne. So she has been through several inter-observer reliability studies within Italy and with her European and American colleagues.
Okay, great. That's helpful. And then when you look at other databases that have been on natural history that have been sort of put out there, I think there have been some that presented by, companies like BioMarin and PTC. Are these data, are they consistent with what you see in those other natural history studies?
Yeah, again, I'll let Dr. McCurry talk about this.
Yes, they are very much. I mean, we have some placebo data from the PTC, which were very consistent with our general cohort, and recently we have a look at the consistency with our subgroups with a similar type of mutation, because that study was limited to a specific subgroup with nonsense mutation. And the same applies with the drisapersen placebo data showed last year at the World Muscle Society. The rate of decline in the first year was pretty similar to our natural history in the placebo, of course.
Okay, that's helpful. And then just a question on background use of steroids. When you look at your cohorts, are we looking at the same types of use? I know there's a difference between continuous and intermittent use of steroids. And then maybe you could comment also on the age of when patients start steroids. If we look at the long-term study for eteplirsen, as you're comparing it to these databases, are all those things kind of relatively similar? Are there some differences there? Can you comment?
Well, I can start out in talking about our study. And if you recall, Lisa, all of the boys had to be on a stable dose of steroids for at least 6 months prior to entry. And we did, and one of the reasons why we chose patients from these two databases, the largest of which was Dr. McCurry's, was because we could identify the use of steroids and the dose. So there was a lot of similarities, again, because standard of care on both sides of the pond were pretty similar. And so these boys were on doses of prednisone and deflazacort at the standard doses that are recommended in the CDC treat NMD guidelines. Even continuous and intermittent dosing was pretty similar between the two cohorts. But I'll let Dr. McCurry talk about the standard of care for steroids for his population.
Yes, we do follow the general guidelines, and children are always started on steroids well before the age of 7 normally. So in this specific group that was used as a control, where the children are all older than 7, all our kids, or the great majority of our kids, were on steroids. The ones who were not were excluded, as shown in the slide, which was showing the filters of including the external controls. There are only very few children in our cohort who are not on steroids after the age of 7, and this is because parents had a personal bad experience with steroids, and they are not keen on their children starting on that. But these are really, really a very, very, very small amount compared to the whole cohort. So many of them will follow. The majority will be on continuous, but I think we have the same proportion of intermittent versus continuous that has been reported in the U.S. and in the U.K. and in other countries.
And what about the age of when you start steroids? Is that an influencing factor at all, and do we have any background information on that?
Well, we do follow the general guidelines. We start proposing steroids around the age of 4, generally. Some parents are happy to start immediately. Some others, especially if the child is improving, because we do know that very, very young boys may show some improvement, may want to wait a bit longer. But definitely, you know, if the inclusion criteria was that they had to be on steroids for at least 6 years, or 6 months, or a year, they were all on steroids for well more than a year at the time when we started. But it's usually the average, which again reflects the percentages that we find in other countries, is between 4 and 6, but closer to 4 than to 6.
Okay, thank you. That's helpful. And then just my final question. I was curious about just the exon 51 and seemingly how much worse they are than other mutations. And this is kind of the first I've heard of that. Can you maybe talk about, is the evidence for that from this study specifically, or is that kind of now been seen in other groups? It's actually fairly interesting. Thank you. That's my final question.
Sure. And actually, Dr. Mercuria has been the one that has really published the most about this, and he's really looked at a lot of various different mutations and looked at the natural history. Dr. Mercuria, can you comment?
Yes. A couple of years ago, we published a paper showing 12-month changes in a cohort of Duchenne subdivided according to mutation and trying to identify the subgroups who were amenable to different exon skippings. And we already found that in the first year, there were some trends, some differences between different groups, with 51 especially having worse performance related to other subgroups. There are other papers, not only from our group, that have shown similar results. A more recent paper by the UK group showed that using a different measure, the North Star, they found that a similar trend to ours in the first year that became statistically significant in 2 years. And there is also another study that was presented last year at the World Muscle Society from the French group, shown that the loss of ambulation in the different subgroups was statistically different, with, again, boys amenable for skipping 51 losing ambulation before the other subgroups. So this comes from multiple sources.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Heather Bahana of Wedbush Securities. Your line is open.
Thanks for taking the question, and congrats on all the data. Just a couple questions, maybe a follow-up on the last one. When you think about, you know, the difference between the exon 51 skipped boys and the other exons, you know, how does that influence your thinking on the current phase 3 study, since you're control is other exons? Is that, you know, as far as powering or time, to see a significant delta?
Yeah, I think, again, and I'll have Eugenio comment more, but, you know, despite the fact that the exon 51 appears to be one of the worst, there's pretty good correlation, especially between 45, 53, and many of the other deletions. Where we see a lot of the discrepancy is, especially duplications and point mutations, seem to be much milder. So even though they are worse, I think it's not a dramatic difference, and especially with many of the exon skipping deletions. So I think it's within the range that that certainly can be tested. But I'll let Dr. Mercuri talk about this also.
Yes, the main difference we notice is really that boys with duplications or point mutations tend to perform better than the ones with deletions. And within the group with deletions, the main difference is really with the boys amenable for skipping 44 performing better than the others, while 45, 51, and 53 have slight differences, but they are pretty much the same. You know, that there are minimal differences among these three groups. So I think the main concern is really if one was going to target boys amenable for skipping 44, because they are the only ones who seem to perform better, and there is an explanation for this. There are a few studies that have been reported in the last couple of years from the UK group and from the Synergy showing how boys who are amenable for skipping 44 may have more traces of dystrophin on redundant fibers that they are not found in the other subgroups.
Okay, I think we're going to need to end the call because our panel does have to get back to the conference and they have other presentations. So I want to thank everyone and really most thank all of the investigators who contributed data, everyone who's helped us in this, and especially the patients and the boys who participated in the study that have really contributed the most to this. So thanks, everyone, for listening on the call.